Hello and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And now you're welcome to join us at our new social medium, pieville.net, P-I-E. Today we're going to do the conclusion to Chapter 6 of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples. And we're going to do pages 227 to 251. This is Chapter 6. I believe this is the third segment, and we'll close it. And Chapter 6 is Cooperation, Altruism, and the Community Control of Group Interest, how Jews kind of police themselves in order to ensure that they are a group, they act as a group, they see themselves as a group, and they obtain all the benefits they can from group loyalty. 227. The group ethic of Judaism and its enforcement within the Jewish community, and begins with some epigraphs. A heathen cannot prefer charges of overreaching because it is said, quote, one his brother, unquote, Leviticus 25:14. However, if a heathen has defrauded an Israelite, he must return the overcharge according to our laws in order that the rights of a heathen should not exceed those of an Israelite. The Code of Maimonides, Book 12, the Book of Acquisition, Chapter 12, 1, 47. Next epigraph, second of three. It is permissible to borrow from a heathen or from an alien resident and to lend to him at interest, for it is written, thou shalt not lend upon interest to thy brother, Deuteronomy 23:20. To thy brother it is forbidden, but to the rest of the world it is permissible. So you can loan money at interest to goyim, but not to Jews. At Jews, you got to loan the money just straight up, without any interest at all. Indeed, it is an affirmative commandment to lend money at interest to a heathen. You have to charge interest if you're loaning to a goyim. For it is written, unto the heathen thou shalt lend upon interest. Deuteronomy 23:21. The Code of Maimonides. Book 13, the Book of Civil Laws, Chapter V, 5, 1, 93. Nesek, N-E-S-E-K, in parentheses, quote, biting or usury, nesek, usury, and marbit, quote, increase, interest, nesek and marbit are one and the same thing. Wouldn't that make a good comic strip? Nesek and Marbit, two Jews. And the dirty thing they were trying to pull on goyim besides loaning the money. Nesek, again, biting or usury. Usury bites you. And Marbit, increase, interest, are one and the same thing. Why is it called Nesek? Because he who takes it bites his fellow, causes pain to him, and eats his flesh. The Code of Maimonides, Book 13, the Book of Civil Laws, Chapter 4, 1, 88, 89. Now, MacDonald, the group ethic of Judaism is also apparent in the formal rules and regulations of Jewish diaspora communities in traditional societies. The present section reviews evidence indicating that Jewish economic behavior was highly conditioned on group membership and that the interests of individual Jews were consistently subordinated to the interests of the group. From the standpoint of the group strategy, the goal was to maximize the total resources of the community, not to allow each individual member to maximize his interest. These regulations were enforced by the powerful centralized Jewish governments that existed throughout the diaspora. Business and social ethics, as codified in the Bible and the Talmud, took strong cognizance of group membership in a manner that minimized oppression within the Jewish community, but not between Jews and Gentiles. Perhaps the classic case of differential business practices toward Jews and Gentiles, enshrined in Deuteronomy 23, is that interest on loans could be charged to Gentiles, but not to Jews, as we heard in the epigraphs. Although various subterfuges were sometimes found to get around this requirement, loans to Jews in medieval Spain were typically made without interest, citing Newman, while those to Christians and Muslims were made at rates ranging from 20% to 40%, citing Leah, L-E-A. Hartung, 92, also notes the Jewish religious ideology deriving from the Pentateuch and the Talmud took strong cognizance of group membership in assessing the morality of actions ranging from killing to adultery, so hardcore dual code extending to the very gravest crimes. For example, rape was severely punished only if there were negative consequences to an Israelite male, while rape of an engaged Israelite virgin was punishable by death. There was no punishment at all for the rape of a non-Jewish woman. So see, that explains their attitude toward one of their own, Leo Frank, raping and murdering a goyish child, literally a child, 13 years old. There's no consequences. Those people have no value and no meaning. They are there purely to serve Jews. And the only thing Jews are concerned about is that their actions toward a goyim might redound or to the damage of the greater community. They care nothing at all about any. There's no individual rights for non-Jews at all. They don't have diminished rights. They have no rights at all to anything. There was no punishment at all for the rape of a non-Jewish woman. No punishment at all for the rape of a non-Jewish woman. You understand how significant that is? While they're spreading, their Jew Saul is spreading universalism and among the goyim. This is what Saul's people actually believe at home. That only Jews have rights. Everything in the world belongs to Jews. They have every right to rape and murder you. And this is why I tell you that the only solution to Jews, they must be exterminated. They pose a threat to us. In their own words, they pose a threat to us. In chapter 4, it was also noted that penalties for sexual crimes against proselytes were less than against other Jews. Hartung notes that, according to the Talmud, B. Sanhedrin 79a, an Israelite is not guilty if he kills an Israelite when intending to kill a heathen. However, if the reverse should occur, the perpetrator is liable to the death penalty. The Talmud also contains a variety of rules enjoining honesty in dealing with other Jews, but condoning misappropriation of Gentile goods, taking advantage of a Gentile's errors in business transactions, and not returning lost articles to Gentiles. Citing Katz. Katz, again, K-A-T-Z, 1961, A, notes that these practices were modified in the medieval and will cheat. In fact, it's a moral commandment they have to cheat non-Jews. Remember, all these people in lockstep, which shows their thickness and their loyalty and their ability to stick to a line, their fidelity to a purpose. Is there claiming that they don't understand where anti-Semitism comes from? After this I've just described you, they don't understand where. Of course they do. They're liars. They're honest among themselves. They treat each other fairly. But they're out to cheat. Ethical norms applied only to one's own kind. Katz. There is also keen concern for restricting competition within the Jewish community in order to maximize the economic benefits to the entire community, even at the expense of individual Jews. Finkelstein, 1924, summarizes the Talmudic law regarding economic competition among Jews. An early Tannaitic, T-A-N-N-A-I-T-I-C, 2nd century A.D. source, forbade Jews to undersell each other. So they correlate on, they collaborate on price, or collude is what it's termed legally, and it's illegal. It just so happens that all the gas stations sell gas at the same price. All the lawyers charge the same price for defending a misdemeanor, say. So Jews can't undersell Jews. However, this regulation was overruled by later sages in the interest of competition inside the Jewish community. Again, the dual code, dual treatment. That's the whole point here, is Jews act one way among themselves, and they have another face they show to you. Finkelstein notes that the French and German commentators supported the proposition that Jews should not compete with each other, but the point was clearly to prevent competition among Jews in trade with Gentiles, not in the trade with Jews. Thus, Rabbi Eliezer B. Joel Halevi ruled that R, the original shopkeeper, may object in accordance with the views of R. Huna, quoted in Finkelstein in 1924. Katz in 1961 finds that there was a large literature on preventing competition between Jews doing business with Gentiles among the Ashkenazim. So the Polish Jews, this is a big subject with them. Like, we have to work it out that we're all on the same page with regard to we're selling gas, we're selling oil, we're selling legal services, we're selling accountant services. Look, guys, hold the line at this price. Profitable. They have to come to us. Don't lower your price. And don't think you can go outside this. We're all together here. That's how they're looking at it. Jews were not allowed to underbid other Jews for franchises, nor were Jews allowed to interfere with monopolies held by other Jews. The point being, quote, not to lose the money of Israel. Similar practices occurred among Jews in the Ottoman Empire, Shah, 1991. Among Italian Jews in the 16th century, there were regulations providing for exclusive monopolies on lending money to Gentiles. See Finkelstein, 1924, 312, 313. And even in the Jewish-dominated banking industry in Germany in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Mossi, 1987, finds that although there were some rivalries among Jewish financial institutions, quote, on the whole, a cooperative spirit, based on a philosophy of give and take and fair shares for all, prevailed. Jews were prohibited from bringing laws were repeatedly enacted and reenacted by the Jewish authorities. Quote, there were constant condemnations and bans of excommunication against those who, quote, reveal the secrets of Israel to merchants or noblemen. Hundert, 1986. Among the Sephardim, the Spanish Jews, the 10%, it was a major crime to cause a fellow Jew to lose property to a Gentile. A synod is just like a gathering, of 1432 ruled that in such cases the culprit was subjected to extreme forms of punishment, including branding on the forehead, whipping, and execution. See Finkelstein, 1924, 363. Close kinship ties as elements of Jewish economic behavior. I did many acts of charity for my kinsmen, those of my nation who had gone into captivity with me at Nineveh in Assyria. Tobias 1:3. I think it's Tobias. There is evidence that close kinship ties have been an important aspect of Jewish economic activities. Zborowski and Herzog, 1952, document the general importance of kinship as implying an obligation to provide assistance. The obligation for relatives to provide assistance is simply assumed and taken for granted, not only within the immediate family, but also within the extended family. Quote, kinship ties, even distant ones, entitle an individual to food, lodging, and support when he comes to visit. In a strange town or city, you seek a relative to stay with. He may be your uncle, your seventh cousin, or the nephew of your brother's mother-in-law. If a man needs a job, a wealthy relative must give him one, if it is at all possible. If not, he must help him to find one. In addition, beside the general patronage of wealthy Jews toward their co-religionists, close kinship relations were of great importance in cementing business ties. Leroy, 1985, notes that Jewish business and commerce in medieval Navarre, that's in France or Spain, were facilitated by intermarriage and family solidarity. This pattern was not significantly altered by the severe persecution that began in the 15th century and continued well into the 18th century. Round, 1969, notes the high degree of endogamy among 15th century new Christian office-holding families, despite their often nominal conversion to Christianity, and notes the role of these alliances in facilitating professional solidarity in the pursuit of patronage. Boyajian, 1983, see also Baron and Beinert and Bernardette and Finkelstein, Halizer and Roth, shows that the Sephardic International Trading Network and the commercial credit it depended on were facilitated by religious and kinship ties among these families. So even if they're forced or willingly converted, they're still keeping their blood ties and their alliances just like when they were proper Jews. Within these families, frequent consanguineous marriages, matching cousins and cousins, uncles and nieces, reinforced kinship and recombined capital for enterprise. The same pattern of kinship and intermarriage among the participants extended to the diaspora and to correspondent bankers in Antwerp and Venice, or even overseas in Brazil and Spanish America. Boyaji in 1983. Similarly, as Johnson, 1987, emphasizes, the court Jews of 17th and 18th century Europe married exclusively among themselves and developed a large network of financial families whose resources could be organized to support particular goals. For example, Samuel Oppenheimer, 1630 to 1703, was able to organize the resources of a, quote, vast network of such families, virtually all of whom were interrelated. It became rare for court Jews to marry any other kind, so that they in effect became a separate endogamous class within the Jewish community. In particular, Stern notes that Oppenheimer's son served as his general representative in the empire and that his two sons-in-law were stationed in the important trading center of Frankfurt. His brother Moses was the principal agent in Heidelberg, and in Hanover he was represented by another close relative, Leffemann Behrens, and his son. In Italy, his interests were supervised by his grandson, and in Amsterdam and Cleves, his relatives, the Gumperts family, were in charge. So a network of Jews extending around Europe, all engaged in some kind of business, working together as a blood group, even within Jews. So there's different levels, but they're a blood clan that's thicker and tighter as you go higher. In Arab Lands, Goetain, 1974, notes that Jews entered into partnerships with other Jews and that these business relationships were cemented by marriage alliances. The Genizan documents from the medieval period, Geniza, indicate numerous business relationships among close relatives, Goetain, 1978, including fathers and sons, brothers, brothers-in-law, cousins, and uncles and nephews. Fischel, 1937, also notes this kinship solidarity among Jews in Arab lands, a solidarity, quote, which economic historians have long recognized as a characteristic feature of Jewish participation in economic life. Deschen, 1986, writing about traditional Moroccan practices, notes that individuals were enmeshed in extensive kinship networks in which kin were responsible for debts and businesses and homes were shared among close kin, and Shaw makes similar comment regarding Ottoman Jewry, that'd be in Turkey. So it's not just in Europe, but around the Mediterranean perimeter. In Arab lands as well as in white lands, Jews are acting exactly the same way. Close familial and business relationships in order to increase the money and power of the Jewish community. Among the Sephardim in 18th century America, highly consanguineous marriages often cemented commercial relationships, as among the Hendricks, Tobias, and Gomez families. It's in 1700s America. Sakhar, 1992. Hyman, 1989, notes that through the 19th century, quote, Jewish family firms were often founded by brothers, and family contacts sustained the mercantile success of Jewish entrepreneurs in both Europe and America, page 185. Moreover, if business partners were not related to begin with, they typically arranged to become related. Solomon Loeb and Abraham Kuhn married each other's sisters, and in the firm of Goldman and Sachs, two Sachs sons married two Goldman daughters, Kaplan, 1983. This pattern of consanguineous, that is, the same blood, business relationships also occurred among the German Jewish merchant bankers in the 19th century, see Sakhar, 1992, for a variety of examples. Perhaps the apotheosis of the Jewish tendency for consanguinity centered around a successful business is the behavior of the Rothschild family during the 19th century. After consolidating their family's position as the wealthiest in Europe, the youngest son of Meyer Amschel Rothschild married his niece, and Morton finds that of the 58 weddings contracted by the descendants of Meyer Amschel Rothschild, that's the founder of the Rothschild banking empire, fully half were with first cousins. So 58 Rothschild weddings, 29 of them are first cousins marrying others. So you're keeping, when you the higher the lowest common denominator, if it's just a little higher than those around you, it repays itself hugely because you have more trust, you have more thickness. Interim conclusion, says MacDonald. The data presented in the foregoing sections are highly compatible with an evolutionary account. : The social and its correlative genetic gulf between Jews and Gentiles was associated with profound differences in economic behavior. Economic behavior in communities with Jews and Gentiles cannot be understood as the atomized transactions of individual actors. Group membership was critical, and especially so for the often large percentage of Jews who were entirely dependent on a, quote, Jewish sector of the economy created and maintained by co-religionists. The data also show that genetic variation within the Jewish community was viewed as a very important resource. The concentration of economic resources coincided to a significant extent with the concentration of genetic variants. The conclusion must be cooperation and charity are associated with the close kinship ties created by connections of biological relatedness between specific families. Again, all very obvious stuff. They work together as a team. And they raise their status, they raise their income, they raise their political power over that of the individual competitors that are our race, the whites. Jewish charity is an aspect of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. So a section on Jewish charity. Two epigraphs. You shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him. Dispersion. That's a diaspora. They may not mingle or intermarry with us, neither they nor their children, and no person may recite from them the benediction of marriage. If anyone transgresses this order and doesn't marry them, whether he act willingly or under compulsion, the marriage is declared void. So if you don't act the way they want, you're effectively ostracized. That's Takanina of the Synod of Frankfurt, 1603, reprinted in Finkelstein, 1924. So you see how the marriage and the enforced behavior over time are going to create a really, really strong, this is who we are, and this is how we act. And, you know, practice makes perfect. Whatever they don't quite have in the genes, well, they work on that. They keep interbreeding. They keep perfecting their genes while they keep perfecting their behavior. There is no question that Judaism has been characterized, and this, of course, is MacDonald now, by high levels of within-group altruism. The general importance of charity within the Jewish community dates from biblical times and is strongly emphasized in the Talmud. Quote, an undying spirit of common responsibility of each individual for the whole group and of the group for the individual. One for all and all for one. Barron, 1952. Emphasizing the group nature of this responsibility, Wucher, 1986, notes that the traditional term tzedakah, T-Z-E-D-A-K-A-H, implies, quote, an obligatory act of justice, not a noblesse oblige expression of personal beneficence, like the naturally given more is expected of us. He's saying it's not the same thing as that. It's saying you have an actual duty to do this. It's obligatory act of justice, not an expression of personal niceness that you're not actually obliged. Tzedakah is a collective communal responsibility. Tzedakah is a collective communal responsibility, one aspect of the larger command to the Jewish people that they pursue justice as a society, that is, justice for themselves. The extent to which charity was emphasized within the Jewish community is truly remarkable, says MacDonald. Writing the traditional shtetl communities of Eastern Europe, Zborowski and Herzog, 1950, an event that was out of the ordinary elicited a contribution to one of the several tin cups that each family had for placing coins intended for various charitable causes. It was not only the wealthy who were expected to be charitable, but everyone, even those who were the recipients of charity. Children were socialized early regarding the importance of charity, partly by being used as go-betweens between donors and donees. Women contributed by visiting the sick and providing them with food and clothing. There was also a variety of official community charitable organizations, including separate organizations for providing clothes with the poor. There was also a community association that gave interest-free loans for starting businesses, and individual charity that helped others entering business was very highly regarded. Penalties for avoiding Jewish charity were severe. The Spanish Synod of 1432 imposed the, quote, stringent harem of 10 maledictions. That's like a curse, a malediction, bad saying, literally, in Latin. Stringent harem, H-E-R-E-M, against tax evaders. Finkelstein, 1924. Goetain, 1971, writing of practices during medieval Islamic times, notes that payments for charitable purposes were viewed as a major religious obligation, analogous to membership dues in a modern religious congregation. Resident foreigners were also forced to pay toward the support of the community poor under threat of being banned. The passage from the Frankfurt Synod of 1603, quoted at the beginning of this section, is also an excellent example of social controls that resulted in altruism among Jews. Individuals were assessed a certain sum of money, and they and their children were threatened with expulsion from the community if they did not comply. But the greatest negative sanction was simply that of public opinion, the cold shoulders, wagging tongues, and raised eyebrows of other community members. So social pressure is used to enforce group norms, particularly charity. Citing Zborowski and Herzog, the social cost of avoiding contributions was, quote, so severe that few would brave it. Again, Zborowski and Herzog cited, wealthy men who were called to read the Torah at Sabbath services had to contribute to the community in return for this privilege. The amount contributed was announced to the congregation in advance of the reading. Wealthy men who developed a reputation for not being sufficiently charitable were called to read the Torah for the explicit purpose of providing group pressure on the individual to contribute. I want to throw in here, do you notice that MacDonald is using almost exclusively Jew sources to document his claims about Jews? So in that, he's doing exactly what the Nation of Islam does in their series about Jews, including a book on the Leo Frank case. He is proving by their own sources that they do the things that he says. So if he is anti-Semitic and an evil Jew hater, as the Jews say, well, then so must the Jews be themselves, because all of his material is drawn from them. He's not drawing one conclusion they don't draw themselves, at least not what we've seen so far. They say that they do the things that he says that they do. In addition to these negative sanctions against those who fail to contribute, there was a strong emphasis on positive reinforcement. A principal source of one's reputation in the community depended on commitment to group goals. Being rich in itself brought far less prestige than being known as generous to the community. So very high levels of philanthropy within the Jewish community for other Jews. The rewards of charity were, quote, so far-reaching and on so many levels that they are almost irresistible. Again, Zborowski and Herzog. Charity is second only to learning in creating prestige for an individual. But even so, being a scholar logically implied that one would not be miserly, a result indicating the extent to which the scholar was expected to embody all of the social ideals of Judaism. A man who is schön, that's a Judaized German, schön, pretty, beautiful, is a man of social conscience, fulfilling his responsibility to the community by service to the group and its individuals. His accepted obligation is to succor, that is to help, and protect those who are less wealthy, less privileged than he. Such a person receives COVED, K-O-V-E-D, deference from others. It was customary to donate within the Jewish community for education as the first priority, e.g. for the medieval period among the Ashkenazim, see Kenar Fogel, 1992. Charity for education served a group function because it would assist the poor but talented Jews to be an economic asset to the entire Jewish community in economic transactions with Gentiles. However, by supporting the education of poor Jews, the economically self-sufficient Jews were also facilitating the development of the skills of children who would compete with their own children within the Jewish community. As discussed in the following chapter, the Jewish community was an intellectual meritocracy in which the ultimate payoff was reproductive success. Charity for the poor was also of great importance. Obligation to the poor was proportional to one's wealth, and all of the poor were to be supported, although we shall see below that in fact there were important limits on Jewish charity. Goetain, writing of practices during the medieval Islamic period, shows that the burden represented by the poor was heavy at times, estimated by Goetain as amounting to one relief recipient to every four donors. Shaw notes that in the Ottoman period, individuals with means were expected to give between one-tenth and one-fifth of their wealth to the poor, so up to 20%, including especially dowries for poor brides. A particularly interesting aspect of community support for the poor was the practice of supporting the marriages of poorer members of the community by providing dowries for poor girls, a practice that dates from at least the 2nd century, citing Barron, 1952. This type of charity is rather directly associated with the reproductive success of individuals whose own resources were insufficient to support a marriage. And because it is so intimately associated with attaining evolutionary goals, it is precisely this type of charity that would be expected to lead to high levels of commitment to the group. They made it possible for me to get married by giving me a dowry. You see? There are many among widely dispersed groups. Neumann, 1969, notes that a Jewish wayfarer was assured of protection and welcome among his brethren in any part of the world. The essential unity of Jewish life in the Middle Ages transcended geographical boundaries and rendered Jews one sympathetic community in which the Oriental, African, Spanish, Italian, and German brethren were perfectly at home with one another. Goetain, 1971, gives numerous examples of Jews supporting the poor in distant Jewish communities in the medieval Arab world. Quote, gifts were sent to localities in which the need was the greatest, so that, for example, Jews in Cairo contributed to ransoming Jews in Byzantium, Spain, and other parts of Europe. Weinrib, 1972, notes that during the anti-Semitic uprisings of the 17th century in Poland, Jews were welcomed as refugees in other Jewish communities in Poland and were ransomed by other Jewish communities from Italy, Constantinople, Amsterdam, and Hamburg. Israel, 1985, describes taxes imposed on communities for charitable and educational activities of the Alliance Israelite Universelle, Western European Jews helping Russian Jews during the pogroms that occurred between 1881 and 1914. Similar tendencies were especially notable during the period of immigration from 1880 to 1920, were evident among Jews in the United States. So we see he's going from Europe to the Arab world to the U.S. and showing that Jews are acting the same across time and across continents. That's your overall takeaway here. Dual code and operating to support other Jews, even Jews that are very far away on different continents, Jews over time are willing to support Jews in different distant countries. Wucher, 86, points out that charitable work is a very central aspect of contemporary American Judaism as a, quote, secular religion, and in fact constituted the main force for Jewish unity, charity work for other Jews, beginning in the early 20th century. Indeed, in the absence of social controls enforcing within-group charity, now that they're out of the ghettos, they're not living right next to each other, voluntary financial contribution to Jewish causes became a defining feature of being a Jew. The obligation to aid other Jews had become, quote, a primary expression of the meaning of Jewishness, Wucher, 86, the primary means for achieving a Jewish identity, for recognizing someone as a Jew, and for maintaining group cohesion in the face of powerful assimilatory pressures. Jewish, that is after Napoleon and 1815 or so, there are no formal sanctions against those who do not contribute. However, by ceasing to participate in Jewish charity, one in effect ceases to be a Jew. Wucher notes, so it's basically these lies about atrocities and charity that form the Jewish identity and then the State of Israel. Wucher notes that by maintaining such an obviously moral requirement, Judaism also gains a sense of moral justification. An important aspect of the ideology that Judaism represents an ethical, quote, light of the nations. Finally, in reading treatments such as that of Zborowski and Herzog, 1952, and Wucher, 86, one gets the impression that charity has always functioned to make each individual your fate is bound up with other Jews. On the one hand, the clear evidence for a very powerful set of institutional controls and strong cultural pressures toward charity is testimony that group strategies must overcome considerable evolutionary inertia that biases people away from high levels of altruism, even within a group that has retained a fairly high level of biological relatedness. On the other hand, the evidence implies that people can accept such a powerful group orientation and that quite high levels of altruism can develop within human group strategies. The importance of Jewish charity as a badge of group membership is particularly good confirmation of the fundamental thesis, indolence and aversion to labor. Let us now avoid such reproaches, which might have been unjust formerly, but which we now should deserve. Let us exert all our influence to accustom our poor, who till now have been fed by our alms, to prefer the gains of labor, even at the sweat of their brows. Letter of M. Burr, Isaac Burr, to his brethren in 1791, on the rights of active citizens being granted to the Jews. Reprinted in Tama, 1807, 1971, 2829. MacDonald says, on page 242, despite the evidence that within-group altruism is an important component of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy, there were important limits on this altruism. As noted in, so now he's against this thesis. As noted in Chapter 1, there are theoretical reasons to suppose that a successful altruistic group strategy must develop ways to protect against freeloaders, and in the case of Judaism, charity toward the poor was neither complete nor unconditional. In the traditional shtetl, those little hovels, societies of Eastern Europe, orphans and the very poor supported by the community had a very low status, and only very minimal provisions were made for their education. Zborowski and Herzog, 1952. These children attended the Talmud Torah, and they were dressed very shabbily. On the other hand, children attending the yeshiva might be equally poor, but they had much more status because of their future prospects in the community. The Talmud Torah children were well aware of their low social status and were the butt of children's hostility. T-O-R-Y-E-A, Talmud Torah, the lowest of the low, the orphans. More importantly, the Talmud Torah children were apprenticed to a trade and had no opportunity to ascend the ranks of scholarship. This gap between the religious ideal and actual practice appears to have resulted in a sort of communal guilt. Quote, uneasiness seems to be associated with the Talmud Torah, which, although it fulfills the shtetl standard of helping the needy, nevertheless countenances a merging of sacred and worldly teaching that violates the traditional spirit of study. Zborowski and Herzog. Despite the Talmudic injunction regarding the obligation to provide dowries for poor girls, the Ashkenazim consistently regulated the marriages of the lower classes, citing Hyman, Katz, Weinrib, and Hundert. Notes that the marriage... Hundert notes that the marriage of poor and indigent Jews came under special scrutiny by community officials. The poor were also prevented from voting in Kehillah elections, citing Katz, 1961. For example, it was common for the Jewish communities of Poland to have a quota of marriages of individuals with less than a certain dowry. Hundert cites a community regulation of 1595 to the effect that, quote, no betrothal may take place in which the bride gives under 150 zlotys, that's Polish money, before there has been an investigation establishing that they will not become a burden on the community. In 1632, a couple was allowed to marry on condition that they not receive any community support for 5 years, and in 1679 and 1681 in Poznan, a regulation was passed prohibiting no more than 6 marriages in which the dowry was less than 400 zlotys. So you don't get married unless you can support yourself. They're not even saying you have kids. Just don't even get married if you can't support yourself. Other communities had a lottery for poor girls allowed to marry. There is some indication that at times the community regulation of marriage was motivated by a concern for an overpopulation of Jews. Katz, 1961, notes that the Kehillah, that's their own self-government, how the community is organized, was often responsible for the postponement of marriages in its wish to limit the number of breadwinners in the locality. If correct, this attempt to gauge the carrying capacity of the environment and regulate the population according to group interests would be a remarkable example of a group-level adaptive response involving altruism on the part of individual Jews. In evolutionary terms, this community control of reproduction is an extraordinary example of the triumph of group interests over individual interests. So the poor person might want to marry and reproduce, but the community's going, no, you're not doing it. You don't have enough money. You're not functional enough. You shouldn't be reproducing. So Jews are very eugenic. They're in line with nature. Although this type of group selectionist thinking about population regulation has long been derided as a general principle of evolution since the writings of Williams, 1966, there is no theoretical reason whatever to suppose that a human group strategy could not develop this type of ability and be able to enforce it. And I want to throw in here that E.O. Wilson, the sociobiologist, the father of the concept of sociobiology, I believe, and the guy who wrote a long book on that name, the part of what made him famous, a guy from Alabama went to Harvard, studied ants, became very famous. He has now come around from the selfish gene, I guess, attitude regarding evolution to the McDonald idea of group evolutionary strategy. And apparently in his new book, which is coming out, I'm talking in 2019, his book's either coming out this year or within a year, he will talk about group evolutionary strategy. So there's some support for this concept. You know, individualism has always been assumed that that's the either the gene or the individual organism is the level at which evolution takes place. But McDonald and now E.O. Wilson, a very, very heavy heavyweight, are saying that, well, some Jews. In evolutionary terms, this community control of reproduction is an extraordinary example of the triumph of group interests over individual interests. Although this type of group selection thinking about population regulation has long been derided as a general principle of evolution since the writings of Williams in 1966, there is no theoretical reason whatever to suppose that a human group strategy could not develop this type of ability and be able to enforce it. Finally, despite the general tendency to minimize social class conflicts within Judaism, highly salient social class divisions did develop at several periods of Jewish history and did indeed result in conflicts of interest. These social class divisions within the Jewish community occurred especially in areas such as 19th century Eastern Europe, where a very large increase in the Jewish population was accompanied by economic and social intermarried oligarchy of rich merchants and lawyer rabbis. Johnson, 1987. See also Zborowski and Herzog, 52. Moreover, it is a salient fact that throughout Jewish history there has been a tendency for the relatively poor and obscure to defect from Judaism, suggesting that within-group altruism is insufficient to overcome the pull of assimilation for these individuals. Nevertheless, Jewish charity has certainly been a very salient feature of Judaism and has certainly contributed to its internal solidarity. Limits on charity are also suggested by the fact that charity has tended to be stronger with more closely related individuals. He notes that wealthy individuals in medieval Islamic times had a duty to keep poor relatives from being a burden to the community. The diminution of Jewish charity with genetic distance can also be seen from the fact that Jewish communities deriving from different areas have often segregated themselves from each other and have prevented foreign Jews from entering. Thus, beginning in the medieval period, European Jews developed the institution of the Harem HaYishuv to deny admittance to newcomers. Yoatain, 1971. Ben Sasson, 1971, describes the ideals of the medieval Hasidim of Ashkenaz, Germany, as attempting to marry completely among themselves and exclude other Jews completely from their community. Israel, 1985, notes a community regulation in England requiring Jews who were admitted to prove that they were financially independent. While such formal institutions did not develop in the Arab world during this period, there is evidence that newcomers who represented competition with local Jews were discouraged from entry. Beginning in the late 19th century into the early decades of the 20th century, there was a major... We have seen that the German Jewish community did provide charity for the immigrants, but there are indications that it was resented and to some extent minimized. Liebman, 1979, quotes a Yiddish newspaper of the period as follows, quote, "In the philanthropic institutions of our aristocratic German Jews, you see beautiful offices, desks, all decorated, but strict and angry faces. Ever." Liebman suggests that these negative attitudes on the part of the German-American Jews resulted in attempts among the new immigrants to build up their own charitable organizations. Moreover, Liebman, 1979, describes, quote, "numerous occasions when the philanthropy of the German Jews coincided with their economic interests to the detriment of the needy Eastern Europeans, including using their positions in charities to recruit cheap labor or to break strikes. It is of interest that the mutual animosity between these two communities of Jews lessened in times of external threat. Pogroms and other threats to Jews in Eastern Europe tended to soften the attitudes of the German-American Jews toward their co-religionists, again citing Liebman. Another indication of the importance of external threat in facilitating group cohesion and altruism. The importance of a gradation in Jewish charity depending on a degree of genetic relatedness is also indicated by the descriptions of the Landsmannschaft societies among Jewish immigrants in the United States presented earlier in this chapter. Mutual aid was a direct function of the physical proximity of the other members of the group, and this physical proximity was closely bound up with endogamous marriage practices. These findings not only show the importance of Jewish charity, but also show that Jews were often highly selective in their charity. The example suggests that, when a choice was necessary because of limited resources, they favored the Jewish individual or group that was more closely related genetically. Thus, the idea that Judaism is simply a religion, rather than a national ethnic movement, breaks down even when thinking about relationships within Judaism. Despite sharing the same religion, charity is preferentially directed to more closely related individuals. Now, that's a good point as well, in making the case that Jews are a religion or a race, and the religion is just essentially a cover for that. Even within Jews, they give more to Jews who are more closely genetically related. So a Jew is not a Jew except when in relation to an outsider. Within themselves, they make distinctions of class and of even lineage, but outside, they oppose the Goyim as one unified group. 247, conclusion. There's a couple more pages here. The material summarized in this chapter indicates that historical Judaism can be characterized as a group evolutionary strategy in which individual self-interest was significantly submerged in the interest of group goals. This group orientation does not imply the absence of competition within the Jewish community. On the contrary, in the following chapter, it will be shown that competition for social and economic status within the Jewish community and its correlative reproductive success was intense. However, the data reviewed here indicate that this intense competition within the group was not allowed to compromise group goals. From the standpoint of the group, it was always more important to maximize the total resource flow from the Gentile community to the Jewish community rather than to allow individual Jews to maximize their interests at the expense of the Jewish community. All for one, one for all. Look, maybe you get a little less rich, but our community as a whole gets a little richer. And don't mess up the group greedily pursuing your own goals. So if white Americans were like Jews, they would say, like, no, you can't bring in low-cost wage labor from Mexico because it makes you richer. You're destroying our country when you do that. You need to pay higher wages to your fellow whites instead. That's the difference in how whites behave versus how Jews behave. And whites have a religion, the majority of them, Christianity, that teaches that the salvation of the individual soul is the most significant thing in the world. And saving souls, not supporting his own group, is the Christian motivation. The material reviewed in chapters 2, 4, and 6 can be viewed as a summary of the main centripetal forces binding Jews to the community and preventing defection from the group strategy. The maintenance of high levels of genetic commonality within the group and a genetic gradient between Jewish and Gentile populations, the development of powerful cultural barriers between Jews and Gentiles, extremely severe sanctions on defectors, or quote, informers and their families, a high level of economic cooperation, and a relative lack of class conflict within the group, and a high level of altruism within the group, which benefited lower status members and provided a safety net for all. In the following chapter, it will be shown that traditional Jewish society was to a significant extent a meritocracy, so that lower status Jews could hope that they or their children could rise in status. Presumably, this also cemented allegiance to the group. If there's, you know, room to move up, that's another reason they would stick around. That concludes the chapter, but we have three pages of notes here. Notes. 1. Mechanisms that result in equality of risk imply selection at a higher level than the units undergoing risk. At the genetic, meiosis evolved as a random process for excluding some genetic variants. Wilson and Sober, 1994, note that this implies that meiosis, apart from meiotic drive, must be conceptualized as a group-level phenomenon. Wow, even within the gene, there's a group-level, or within the cell, there's group-level strategy. This is also presumably the reason why, quote, drawing straws and other random determinations are sometimes used as a mechanism for determining who should engage in dangerous work for the benefit of the community, e.g. military draft lotteries, implying selection at the group level. It is also the reason why social controls at the community level that significantly lower reproductive success are that significantly level, I'm not sure if that's not a misprint, reproductive success and access to resources within groups, as proposed here for Judaism, imply group level processes. I would say lower. I think he meant lower. Combined with data indicating group differences in fitness, this implies selection at the group level among humans. So see, he's not just talking about Jews. He's trying to basically prove his theory that group evolutionary strategy even exists. I don't think that's even really proved. But like I'm saying, the fact that someone as heavyweight as E.O. Wilson would now support that shows there's probably something to it. 2, the theory of anti-Semitism developed in SAID implies that, that's his other book, implies that in cases of group conflict, examples of immoral behavior by individuals tend to be uncritically generalized to the group. Community control over individual external threats, with the result that group allegiance is heightened. 4, in 1618, a French diplomat noted that Jews, quote, are numerous and influential in Amsterdam and have exceedingly intimate relations with the state because they are equally attentive to foreign news and to commerce. In both matters, they obtain their the Jew network, rabbinical or synagogue network, existed long before the internet. By this means, the Jews in Amsterdam are the first and best informed about foreign commerce and the news of what these practices are the source of their riches. Baron, 1973, states that these remarks may be exaggerated, but they undoubtedly contain a grain of truth. 5. Shaw, 1991, also notes that because Jews controlled the customs in the Ottoman Empire, they charged non-Jews more money on their goods, another competitive advantage of ethnic solidarity. 6. The Deuteronomic law of interest has been variously interpreted throughout Jewish history, and an apologetic historiographical literature has developed. Whether, well, it's not like that. Let me say that with, you know, literal words, but it's not really what it meant, you know. It's the typical Jewish bullshit that they didn't have a dual code. They're trying to hide what they're doing. These issues are discussed in SAID Chapter 7, in which Roman agents investigating the ethics of the Talmud disagreed with this passage, but did not tell their government. During the medieval period, several prominent Jewish apologists vigorously defended the differential treatment of Jews and Christians regarding money lending. There were also attempts to argue that Talmudic references to heathens or idolaters, akum, A-K-U-M, in matters of differential ethics, did not apply to Christians. Rosenthal, 1956, see also Rabinowitz, 1938, notes that despite this type of argument, the Jewish masses, quote, did not differentiate between the non-Jew in the Talmud and the non-Jew of his time. And Stein, 59, and Katz, 61, notes that the idea that Gentiles were not idolaters and thus not subject to an ethical double standard continued to be controversial among Jewish thinkers. Maimonides, for example, explicitly viewed all Christians as idolaters. McCobie argues that since medieval Christians behaved savagely toward Jews, it was reasonable that they be viewed as akum. Monopoly, give up his exclusive rights in favor of competition that would tend to lower interest rates to the advantage of the Gentiles. 9. These practices were a potent fuel for anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitic writers often condemned Jews for proscriptions on doing business with Christians. Non-Jews attempted to respond in 1992 suggests that the strong tendency toward consanguinity, shared blood, resulted in a tendency toward mental retardation among the Gomez family. So they interbred enough that there were problems that came from it. 11. This percentage would undoubtedly have been higher had first cousins always been available. The four sons born to James and his wife, niece Betty, all married exogamously, the marriages occurring between 1905 and 1913 at a time when marriage to a first cousins was impossible because of lack of availability. As noted in Chapter 4, Note 22, the Rothschild marriage strategy shifted from establishing attractive alliances to consanguinity after the Rothschilds became the wealthiest family of Europe. 12. So maybe that means the more money and status and power you have, the more pure you want to keep your blood, the more in-house you want to keep your breeding. 12. And final, Herlihy, 1991, and that almost sounds like the only non-Jew name he ever cites in this chapter. I mean, if Herlihy's a Jew name, then God help us. Makes this point in assessing the importance of the ability to marry in explaining the powerful group orientation of the early medieval city-states in Greece and Rome. So, okay, he's not really dealing directly with Jews, maybe. Under conditions, Herlihy, quote, under conditions of acute moral commitment was essential for the welfare of the state, had to be granted some participation in it. But another, equally crucial means of maintaining commitment and morale was to offer all citizens access to marriage. Not only would they gain the satisfactions of sexual union, but the rearing of the family and the acquisition of heirs would give them a large stake in the salus populi. Similarly, the ability to marry would be a highly salient force that would tend to create allegiance to group goals among Jews. So he's saying the same motives apply within Jews. So there you go. That's the end of chapter 6, and you just see that Jews are marry among themselves, and they have a dual code. And they've been doing this for thousands of years. So they worked out their genes and they worked out their behavior and they've got a winning strategy and their power comes from it, from knowing who they are, knowing how they live, and knowing where they intend to go. And if part of their agenda is doing us in via white genocide, I guess we better form a team to fight back. And that has to be, as always, the last thought I'm leaving you with. Thanks for listening to me. I'm Alex Linder. I've been reading to you from Chapter 6 of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. You can find this and all we record at vnnforum.com. Join us on social media to discuss news related to this type of evergreen knowledge at pieville.net. Thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again real soon for more from MacDonald.